Hello everyone, and welcome to Daf Yomi Shabbat, one week at a time. Today is our 12th lesson, if you can believe it. I just want to start by saying I hope everybody is safe and healthy in their homes, wherever you are, and just sending out good wishes of health and sanity to everybody who is at home. And I'm just very thankful that we have this online learning and that we're able to learn together. This week we are going to do a summary of Daf Yud Bet 12 till Yud Chet till 18. There were a number of concepts that we've encountered throughout these Dafim, so we are going to go over the concepts one at a time. Again, if you have any questions, feel free to put them in the chat box, and hopefully I will be able to answer all of your questions. So Daf Yud Bet picks up from the bottom of Yud Aleph and talking about a person, a man who's called a Zav. A Zav is a man who has an unnatural seminal emission. And the way the halakha works is that he has to make sure or check how many emissions he has over within 24 hours or within 3 days. But the idea is he needs to see if he has one, two, or three emissions. And we were talking about this concept of him wearing a pouch in order to check if he had this emission or not. And the question was, is he allowed to wear this pouch on Shabbat? And the question is, because it's, you know, does he not really want it there, and therefore it would be okay? And there's a machloket there on Daf Yud Bet, on 12. Another concept in the world of purity, Tum'ah and Tahara, purity and impurity. We're going to talk more about that in a little bit. But one is with regards to produce. And there's a concept called Zechi Yutan, based on a pasuk that talks about how produce can become ritually impure. And it is only after it has become wet. Now you might say, well, you know, it rains in the field and the produce is getting wet all the time. The Torah tells us that water needs to be intentionally put on the fruit or produce, and that makes it able to become impure. Again, it doesn't make it impure, it makes it able to become impure. So that is the concept of v'chi yutan, and it is machshir, it makes the produce susceptible to tum'ah. We're going to get to that in a little bit. Another concept that came up on Daf Yud Bet on 12 is this idea that men, again, for those of you who were learning Masechet Brachot, men were wearing their tefillin all day. And therefore, we mentioned on Daf Yud Bet, Chayav Adam Lemashmesh B'tefillin. A man needs to constantly be aware of the tefillin that he is wearing. The words mean he has to actually touch them, but it doesn't mean physically touch them, but be aware of his tefillin. And therefore, the Gemara says that because he needs to be aware of his tefillin at all times, he can wear them on Erev Shabbat, on Friday before Shabbat, because he's aware of it at all times. And therefore, before Shabbat starts, he will take them off, he will remove them so as to not carry them on Shabbat. And the parallel was made to the Kohen Gadol, to the high priest, who in the temple would wear what was called the tzitz. It was basically a golden headband that was written Kodesh LeHashem, with God's name, basically sanctified to God. And the Gemara says that just like the Kohen, the priest needed to be aware of the seat of this headband at all times, and it only mentions God's name once, so too the tefillin have, or I would say so much more so, the tefillin that have God's name many times, a person needs to be much more aware. And therefore, again, the Gemara says that the person can wear the tefillin before Shabbat because he will remember to take them off after Shabbat, before Shabbat starts. Daf Yud Bet 12 continues and talks about how to kill lice on Shabbat or to remove them from the clothing. I'm not going to get into too many details, but just one interesting thing is that in the time of the Gemara, they thought that that lice spontaneously reproduced, and that maybe they weren't, that we don't necessarily categorize them as animals. We know that we're not allowed to kill animals on Shabbat, but maybe lice are not really animals. And again, this idea that they spontaneously reproduced, there is a machloket there on that daf, whether or not you can kill them or not. At the end, we say that you cannot kill lice on Shabbat, and you can check there for that that discussion. The bottom of Yud Bet talks about not touching a lamp on Shabbat, a ner, just to remind us that in the time of the Mishnah, the Gemara, and in a few days we're going to start Bameh Madlikin, the chapter that really talks about what the lamps look like. But just to remember, we're not talking about a candle that is wax, but basically an oil lamp, meaning a clay vessel that was filled with oil and there was a wick that was lit. Now we're nervous, and throughout this past week's dapim, we've been talking about, let's say, reading with the light of a candle, of this lamp. I don't want to say candle because that implies, wax. And the question is, why can't you light with this lamp? And the Gemara says, Shema yate et haner. We're nervous that you're going to basically tilt the lamp so that the wick gets more of the oil. And that is actually a problem for a burning on Shabbat. And that's a problem, and therefore we're not allowed to read by using the lamp light. I will just say for a second, and just interrupt myself, what is really challenging when we're learning Gemara is that normally we're used to, when, let's say, we're learning a new subject, let's say if you're in a university and you open up a textbook, generally the first few chapters are an introduction and it gives you the fundamental principles, and only later on it gets into maybe more complicated discussions. It's really important to realize as we learn Gemara that, and I've mentioned this before, there's no real beginning and end, even though, we do start at the beginning and we do go towards the end. But in terms of, there's no, introduction, middle, body, conclusion. The Gemara basically assumes you know everything. So that really makes it challenging to those who are just starting to learn Gemara. Let's say we're talking about the laws of Shabbat, but we have yet to discuss the 39 actions or laws or principles that are not allowed or forbidden on Shabbat. So that's going to come much later in the Masechet, in the tractate. So I want you to bear with me, with the Gemara. I'm going to try to explain as much as I can, but just realize if you're not understanding things, it's because the Gemara hasn't actually explained them yet. So it does take, I would say, a lot of patience and understanding, and I will, as I mentioned, try to explain the concepts as they come up. So again, we're not allowed to burn things on Shabbat, so anything that causes something to burn would be a problem. So that's our problem with the lamp. I just thought it was beautiful that on Daf Yud Bet we talk about Bikur Cholim, visiting the sick, and it really made me think of basically the entire world that is in their houses in quarantine or semi-quarantine. There are many who know of people who are sick, so I just thought it was so applicable that in Daf Yomi we were talking about how do we visit the sick. And the discussion there about praying for the sick, and that if you're praying for someone, a concept in Judaism is that you don't only pray for, let's say, one person, you pray for the community, or you pray for everyone who is sick. And this is actually the source on Daf Yud Bet, this idea that when we pray somebody who is sick, we say B'toch Sha'ar Chole Yisrael, meaning we know that, let's say, a certain person is sick and we mention that person's name, but we also say we are also praying for the entire community or everyone else that is sick as well, meaning we make it a personal but also a communal prayer. So I think that that's just really important to understand in our prayers. Daf Yud Gimel talks about more about purity and impurity. And again, as I mentioned, Rabbi Nathan Farber has these beautiful images. So I just wanted to bring this for you so you can see just an overview of purity. Again, tum'ah in Hebrew, tum'ah is impurity, tahara is purity. It's very important to realize we are not talking about cleanliness. It is not about clean or unclean. It's really a halachic, conceptual, maybe spiritual construct, not anything physical in terms of clean or unclean. So here are the levels. I'm not going to get into too many details. I'm happy if you have any questions, I can answer them. But just things you should know. And again, I'm sorry to keep referencing what's going on nowadays, but it really makes me think of a contagious disease. Because the way tumah works is it is transmitted from one object to another. So if you look at the top, we have avi avot hatuma, meaning maybe the grandfather of tumot, the most, I would say, the most serious type of tum'ah, of impurity, is a dead body. And that is, if you touch the dead body, or I guess I can mention it now, but it came up later on in this week's daf, what's called an ohel, meaning if there is, an ohel means a tent, but it means anything that covers a dead body. Let's say if a dead body is in a room, then anything in that room becomes tameh as well, meaning anything under that roof. Let's continue. An av hatuma would be a person who touched that dead body, or what's called a sheretz. A sheretz is a creepy crawly animal. There are 8 shretzim that are mentioned in the Bible. They're like lizards and rodents and specific different types of creepy crawly things. There are 8 of them. If they touch a utensil or a person or a food, they make it tameh. Now each one of these levels will create different types of realities, and we can talk about that, I think, another time, because it doesn't really come up in this daf. Okay, so we have an av hatuma. So we said that's the person who touched a dead body, or the sheretz, or a nevela is a dead animal. A zav, I mentioned before, is a man who has an unnatural seminal emission. Mitzora is somebody who has leprosy, again, biblical leprosy. Metal utensils that touch an avatuma, also talking about touching a dead body. Okay, the next thing is a Rishon Lituma, meaning Rishon means first. So after the father of Tuma, you have a Rishon, I would say maybe first degree. That would be a person or a utensil or food that touched anything in the list above. The next is Sheni, second degree, would be a food or a liquid that touched anything in the level above. Again, a person can only, if you notice, a person can only be up to a Rishon. Food or liquids can be a Sheni, Sheni being second degree. And then it stops there. Shlishi is anything that has, I would say, a special sanctity, like kudshim. Kudshim means food that are sacrifices that are going to go or have special sanctity. Truma also are the gifts that were given to the priest, to the kohanim. And revi'i, again, is only kudshim, meaning basically food that was part of a sacrifice. So you see that basically a person can only get up to Rishon, regular food only to Sheni, and then things that have more sanctity, like Truma, is till Shlishi, till a third degree, and things that are sacrifices, Kudshim, are Revi'i, fourth degree. So I'm just going to let you, you can look at that. How does this come up? It comes up in our discussion of purity in the following dapim. Okay, Daf Yud Gimel talked about sleeping in a bed with somebody who you're not allowed to have relations with. Again, a nida is a woman who is having her period, and she is not allowed to have relations with her husband. Again, just to remind you, in those days, they did not have pajamas, so generally they slept naked. So the Gemara asks, what if, you know, you're wearing clothes? Can you sleep in the same bed? The answer is no, by the way. Okay. The next are, the Gemara mentions the 18 decrees or 18 conflicts that the schools of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai were in conflict with. And Beit Shammai were actually on this day, this specific day, were in the majority. And therefore, Beit Shammai won these conflicts, these disagreements, machlokot, and we're going to basically go through all 18. So the first one we mention is the Megillat Ta'anit. A Megillat Ta'anit was basically a scroll that listed all the days that something miraculous happened, and therefore you were not allowed to fast on those days. So that scroll was actually lost. Daf Yud Dalet is going to continue with our 18 decrees. And just back to our list of purity and impurity, two more concepts that are important is the Gemara will mention the word leaf. Sol, basically to make it pasul, to make it...
This is so annoying. It was so good in the car.
Okay. Sorry about that. So there are the two concepts that are used for tum'ah is lifsol and litameh. If something becomes pasul, it becomes tameh, but it cannot transmit that tuma. Leaf soul basically means it stops here.
I'm saying nothing now.
It receives the tuma, but it does not transmit the tuma. Litameh, though, means that it becomes tameh, but it also becomes, it can also then transmit. So that's just
important.
What?
No, I'm not paying attention to piercing.
I can ask everybody to mute themselves. For some reason, I'm hearing some background noise. If you can please mute yourselves, I would appreciate it. Thank you. Okay. The next concept that came up on Daf Yud Dalet on 14 is talking about the mikvah, and just to understand that once someone or something becomes tameh, it can enter the ritual bath, the mikvah, in order to become tahor, to become pure. The Gemara talks about different decrees that were made to make sure that people understood that the mikvah is the only place that you could become pure. And not if, let's say, you poured water on top of you, the Gemara made it very clear that that would not make you pure. And basically what the Gemara explains is that in the old days, they didn't have these beautiful ritual baths, the mikvaot that we have nowadays that are clean and nice, but they would basically go in, you know, rainwater or in a cave that had rainwater, and a lot of times the water was very dirty, so people would go into the mikvah. When they came out, they would basically pour water on themselves to clean themselves off. The Gemara said they were very nervous, the rabbis were very nervous that people would think, oh, all I need to do is pour water on myself, and forget that they actually had to go into the mikvah beforehand. And therefore they said that if you poured water on yourself, it would actually make you impure. Another concept that comes up a few times is, again, I mentioned truma before. Truma is food that was given as a gift to the Kohanim, to the priests. It had a special sanctity. As I mentioned before, it can become a third degree of tameh, of tum'ah, of impurity, as opposed to regular food. If it becomes tameh, you actually need to burn it, lisruf. You need to burn it if it becomes tameh. And the Gemara discusses if we're not sure if it becomes tameh, then it's, the Gemara says you have to litlot, which basically means to hang it up. You basically put it aside, you wait till it rots, and then you throw it out. So litlot means when I'm not sure if it became tameh, you kind of hang it up. Lisrof means to burn it completely. Daf Tetvav talks about the three machlokot, the three arguments that Shammai and Hillel had. Again, the people, Shammai and Hillel, the sages, as opposed to Beit Shammai, the students of Shammai versus the students of Hillel. Shammai and Hillel had three disagreements. One about chala. Chala is another gift that was given to the priest, to the Kohanim. If you were making bread, then you needed to separate a small amount to give it to the Kohanim. This is still done today. We actually separate challah, but we either burn it or we throw it out because we don't give the gifts to the Kohanim nowadays because we don't have the temple. So there's a machloket, there's a disagreement on how much flour you need to use in order to have to take challah. The other machloket was about how much water will invalidate a mikvah. And the third was about a woman who is in nidah. If she sees blood, then the question is, when is she considered impure from? This is actually something that is discussed in Masechet Nida, which was the last Masechet of Shas, of all of the Talmud. But the conversation is either she just becomes Tameh, or the things that she touches from then and on, from when she saw it, or from the last time she checked herself, and the halakha is actually 24 hours backwards. The Gemara continues on Tetvav on 15 and discusses what happens when we have a tum'ah, impurity that we're not sure about. And it says that when we're not sure about certain tum'ah, what should we do? And one concept is the concept of a Beit HaPras. A Beit HaPras is a field that they found a grave or I would say a bone from a dead body, but there is no grave there, and therefore you know that it's, the field also has been plowed. So we don't know where the bones are in the field, so you have to just be very careful because there is the potential to become tameh in that entire field. The Gemara at the end of Tet Vav and onto Tet Zayin, onto 16, discusses glass vessels. It's important to understand, as we mentioned on this chart here, it's important to understand that when we talk about vessels, in the Bible, in the Torah, we have two types of vessels. Clay cheres, which is earthenware, which is clay, and metal. The question is, what happens with glass? Because on one hand, as the Gemara mentions, glass is made out of sand, which we could say is similar to earthenware. On the other hand, it could be more similar to metal. It's much more solid, and there are other similarities. So there are differences in terms of purity and impurity with regards to earthenware vessels and metal vessels. One being that you can purify a metal vessel, whereas you can't purify an earthenware vessel. The other is if you take an earthenware vessel and you break it, or you know, make a very large hole in it where it's not a very useful vessel anymore, it loses its impurity. And if you fix it, it continues to be pure, meaning it doesn't revert back to its impurity. Whereas a metal vessel, it will revert back to its impure state once it is repaired. I'm going to skip a little bit because there's just a lot of concepts that I want to get to. The Kutim are a nation that are mentioned on Daf Tet Zayin on 16. It's very interesting about the Kutim, depending where you're learning in what section of the Talmud, we have different opinions on how to understand this nation of people. This is a nation that was brought into the land of Israel in the time of the exile of the ten nations. And they actually, the Gemara tells us that they converted to be Jewish, but the sages weren't sure how authentic their conversion really was, and if they really were, if they're really considered Jewish or not. So actually in our daf, they are considered Jewish with regard to the laws of purity and impurity. Moving on to daf Yud Zayin 17, we mention again this concept of Tumat Ohel, which I mentioned before. It's up here. Tumat Ohel is when, again, I mentioned a dead body is found under something. Again, an ohel is a tent, but it could be any vessel that kind of makes a enclosure over a dead body. Anything under that will also become impure. And the Gemara on 17 on Yud Zayin talks about what that vessel could be, the thickness, the circumference, and things like that. From there, we discuss harvesting grapes. And again, as I mentioned in the beginning of this shiur, we talked about fruit or produce needs to get wet in order for it to be susceptible to impurity. The question is, if you're harvesting grapes and you know some of the liquids drip out onto the other grapes, does that count as making it susceptible to purity or to impurity or not. And the conversation on this daf is really about do we want that liquid to come out or no, right? And it discusses like if the basket is lined and will keep in the liquid, then we want that liquid because that's going to be our grape juice or our wine. If the water is coming, if the liquid is coming out and we're going to lose it, then we don't want that to happen. So that's the discussion on Daf Yud Zayin. And then we get to a new Mishnah on Daf Yud Zayin, at the end of Yud Zayin, where we're talking about starting an activity before Shabbat that will continue onto or through Shabbat. And the question is, are you allowed to do that? Again, as I mentioned, we haven't really mentioned the activities we're not allowed to do on Shabbat, but the assumption here is, let's say I'm not allowed to do it on Shabbat, can I set an action in motion if it will happen on Shabbat? And then the question is it by itself or not, meaning without any action on my part? So the Mishnah talks about making ink and discusses that how did they make ink? So Rashi talks about there's two steps. One is actually creating the powder, and the other is taking the powder and then turning it back into ink. So Rashi talks about taking basically coal or things that have been burnt and mixing it with oil to create like a paste and then drying that out to create a powder. And then that powder, in order to make it back into ink, you would add water and that would make it into ink. So the issue here is the action is called lash. Lash means to knead. But what's the idea of kneading is you add water to a powder, right? Normally, if I make dough, I take flour and water, and then I knead the dough. So the Gemara is discussing, can I add water, and that will create a new substance, even without me kneading it? Or not necessarily, meaning do I need to knead it or not? Is that the action that is forbidden on Shabbat? The concept that we also get here is a concept called Shvitat Kelim. The words actually mean like resting our vessels, meaning we know that on Shabbat we're not allowed to do work. But the Torah also says that our animals are not allowed to do work, and anything that we own is not allowed to do work on Shabbat. So what happens, right, can I do something where work will be done, but I'm not doing anything actively on Shabbat? And the discussion on Daf Yud Chet is if it's actively doing work, like it talks about the mill, right? In the old days, the way they ground wheat, right? They would put the wheat in a mill with a grindstone, and then either a person, an animal, would turn that grindstone. So that we understand is not allowed to be done on Shabbat. But the Gemara talks about what if I have a water-powered mill? So let's say I just open up that lever before Shabbat, and the water is going to power the mill on Shabbat. Would that be okay? So that's a machloket. That's a disagreement between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. And one says no, all your vessels, everything that you own needs to rest on Shabbat, even if you're not doing any active work. Whereas the other will say, no, as long as you're not doing anything, then it can continue on its own. So that's the machloket in the Gemara on Daf Yud Chet. And it talks actually about putting food on the stove, on the fire, before Shabbat and leaving it there for throughout Shabbat. And the Gemara says, what, first of all, what's the problem? The concept is called Shema Yachteb Bagichalim, right? I am nervous that you will come to stoke the coals, the Gichalim, the coals. So we're nervous you're going to stoke the coals. That, of course, would be a problem, in terms of hastening cooking and bishul, right? Cooking is a problem, is forbidden on Shabbat. So the Gemara says that if your food is completely raw, you can put it on the fire before Shabbat, because the assumption is you will not touch it all night because it just needs to sit there and cook. This is something that is actually very practical. If anybody, let's say, has a crock pot, a slow cooker, if you're going to make challent on Shabbat, the question is when do you make that challent before Shabbat? So either it needs to be raw at the beginning of Shabbat, right? Going into Shabbat, it's raw, and therefore you won't even have any desire to touch it because it needs to cook. The other option is that it has to be completely cooked, or at least almost all the way cooked, edible. If it's half raw and half cooked, then we have a problem because we're concerned that you'll actually try to stir the coals in order for it to cook quicker. And the last thing on Daf Yud Ched on today's Daf was a discussion on the limitations of selling things to non-Jews right before Shabbat. And the discussion was, right, if I sell something to a non-Jew, it looks like he's carrying my things, let's say, home to my house before Shabbat or on Shabbat. And therefore, the Gemara says that if I'm going to sell something to a non-Jew before Shabbat, I have to make sure that there's enough time for the non-Jew to be able to either get to his own house before Shabbat, get to a house before Shabbat, or even just get into the city. But there is this concept of it looking like he's carrying my things, carrying my things for me. And I thought, just again, you know, my family always laughs at me because every week I say, look how amazing it is to learn Daf Yomi. It's so practical and it talks exactly about what we needed to learn about. Basically, the last line of the Daf is talking about selling chametz before Pesach, which is something we are going to need to do in the next coming weeks. But the concept of selling chametz, can you sell chametz before Pesach? And the discussion is only if you know that the non-Jew will be able to finish your chametz before Pesach. Again, not that he has to, but he has the ability to. Lynn just is asking, oh, the last third can be yet uncooked going into Shabbat in modern halakha. Yes, it has to be. In modern halakha, we talk about this concept of, it's called ma'achal ben drusai, which means it's at least, I forgot if it's a third cook or halfway cooked, meaning like we all know that if, let's say, you have a steak, so some people like it rare and some people like it well done. As long as it's edible and is considered cooked by some people, then you can put it on your, you know, on the fire before Shabbat, because again, the assumption is you're not going to touch it. You're going to let it just kind of heat up or stay on the stove. So that is, we're going to talk more about cooking as we get later on in this masechet. Again, the stove, you know, has to be covered, it has to not have coals on it. We'll talk more we'll talk more, I guess, practically when we get to more details about cooking. But now I wanted in our remaining time, I wanted to go back actually to Daf Yud Bet, and it discussed, I thought it was just very interesting. It's just like two lines in the Gemara, but I thought it was just an interesting thing that we could discuss here. On Daf Yud Bet, it talks about praying in Hebrew versus praying in Aramaic. And it says, le'olam al yishal adam trachav b'lashon arami, that you should, a person should never request his needs, meaning pray, in Aramaic. And then it says that Rabbi Yochanan said, anyone who requests that his needs be met in the Aramaic language, the ministering angels do not attend to him and bring his prayers before God. So it says that if you pray in Aramaic, in the vernacular in the time of the Gemara, the angels will not help his prayers. And the last line is She'en Malachei Sharit Mikirin B'Lashon Arami, because the ministering angels don't understand Aramaic, but only understand Hebrew. So I thought that this was a very interesting concept that will lead us into an interesting discussion. So first I just want to understand this idea of angels, because if we think about it, when we pray, we are told that we should pray directly to God, right? We do not pray to any intermediaries, which is what is generally thought. But what's interesting is if you look at the slichot prayer, the slichot are prayers that we say before the high holidays, right before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. There is one poem that talks about our prayers, and it says, "Machnisei rachamim, hachnisu rachamenu." Right, those that bring in mercy, bring in or compassion, right? Bring in mercy or compassion before God, lifnei ba'al harachamim. So it sounds like we're saying to the angels, right? Angels, we're praying, please help facilitate our prayers and bring them before God. So it's interesting that this prayer and the Gemara that we just mentioned seem to imply that there are angels who basically kind of take our prayers up to God. So if you look at the Tosfot, again, the Tosfot is the commentary on our Gemara, the Tosfot says, She'en Malachei Sharet Mikirin Belashon Arami. The Tosfot actually questions our Gemara. Really, the angels don't understand Aramaic? But don't we know that Gabriel, the angel, is said to have taught Joseph 70 languages in Egypt? So we see that Gabriel definitely knows 70 languages. So Tosfot says, oh, maybe it's just Gabriel, but all the other angels maybe don't understand Aramaic and they only understand Hebrew. And then the Gemara says, "V'teima de'afilu machshava shebelev kol adam yodin, v'lashon arami en yodin." The Gemara says, "Is it true that the angels don't understand Aramaic, but don't the angels hear or know what is going on in the hearts of man?" So that's an interesting concept, that angels know what we're thinking or what we're feeling. But what's interesting is that the Torah actually says that only God hears what's in our hearts. Right? Look what it says here in Divrei Hayamim, in Chronicles. It says, "For you alone know the hearts of men." Right? Ki atal levadecha, only you, God, knows what's going on in the hearts of man, implying that angels do not know what's going on in the hearts of man. In Genesis, we see that when the angels come to visit Abraham, they actually say, "Vayomru elav ayesara ishtecha right? They asked Abraham, where is your wife? So you see that the angels actually don't know what's going on other than what they see, or I guess what they hear. So it's interesting to think about, do the angels hear what's going on in our hearts? Those of you who have learned brachot in the past few weeks, so we finished brachot by talking about prayer, and it says that if you lengthen or prolong your prayer too much, it's not good, right? Anyone who prolongs his prayer and expects it to be answered will ultimately come to heartache. And the question is why, right? We would think that, if you see great rabbis who stand in prayer and seem to take a very long time to pray, you'd think that taking a long time is a good thing. So Rashi explains that what does it mean that you're ayen bo, that you prolong it? Omer v'li bo, right? The person says in his heart that, I'm going to spend a long time in my prayer, therefore God is for sure going to answer me, right? Omer v'li bo she'te'aseh bakashato lefi she'itpalel b'kavana, right? Because I had such great concentration, God is definitely going to answer my prayers. And that hubris actually gets us in trouble, because Rashi explains that when the angels hear this, or hear what's going on in a person's heart, that he is so confident about his ability to pray, then Rashi says, "Maskiwin avonotav." Right, then the angels go up to God and say, can you check out this guy, because he seems to be very sure that you're going to answer his prayers, right? And then they check his ma'asav, his deeds, right? Is he actually worthy of having his prayers answered? So this seems to contradict what we just said in terms of angels not hearing what's in our hearts, right? And it seems that here angels are hearing what's going on in our hearts. So I think the way to understand this, nobody really knows, but I think the way to understand it is, when we're praying, I think it's very important for us to pray to God, right, and not to an intermediary. It's very important, I think, especially for us to recognize that in Judaism, every person is able to daven, to pray directly to God, right? That's what's so beautiful about our prayers, is that there are no intermediaries. However, what does the Gemara mean when these implying that the angels are intermediaries? I think the idea is that there are angels who are there to help facilitate our prayers, who help maybe sharpen our prayers or bring them, maybe closer to God. But when we're praying, we have to make sure that we do that directly to God and not to any of these intermediaries. I think this comes up especially when people go to the graves of very holy men who have passed away, to rabbis and sages. It's very important to realize that when we do that, when we pray at a gravesite, we are not praying to that great rabbi. We are praying to God and saying that we hope that the merit of this rav will help in the acceptance of our prayers. But since we mentioned this idea of prayers being in another language, I think the question is, right, can we pray in other languages? And I think this question comes up very often to those who, first of all, don't understand Hebrew, to those who are new to prayer, even those who are not new to prayer, who want to understand their prayers. Do we daven, do we pray in other languages? Source number 8 brings there's a Mishnah that says that the following list may be said in any language, right? And not specifically in Hebrew. And what can be said in any language? I didn't bring the entire list, but mentioned in this Mishnah is Kriyat Shema, so the prayer of Shema, Tfilah, which we know in the Gemara means Shmonasri, the silent Amida, and Birkat HaMazon, and the grace after meals. So we see very clearly in black and white that these prayers can be said in other languages. So now let's go back to our original conversation. It said in Daf Yud Bet of our Masechet that you should not pray in Aramaic, rather you should pray in Hebrew. But we just learned in this last source that you can pray in any language. So I think that really the concept here is twofold. I think one is the importance of understanding what we're saying, right? If it's about pouring our hearts out to God, it's very important to know what we're saying. And therefore, if you do not understand the words, I think it is definitely recommended before praying to read it in English, but even while you're praying to say the words in English so that you can understand what you are saying. That being said, I think that our Gemara is coming to say that there is a very special connection between us and God through the language of Hebrew. Meaning, you know, we call it Lashon HaKodesh, right? It is a holy language. I think that there's a special power to praying in Hebrew. And I think that that is ultimately what our Gemara is trying to express. And therefore, there are those who will say that it is preferable to pray in Hebrew, even if you don't understand the words. I personally would say I think it's more important to understand the words, but as soon as you do, I would go back to saying them in Hebrew, or maybe saying both Hebrew and English. But our Gemara definitely is saying that there is a special power to Hebrew. There is a special connection between us and God via the Hebrew language. And there's also a special connection between us and the angels through the language, right, the Lashon HaKodesh, Hebrew. And I think that that's what our Gemara is trying to impart to us, the importance of davening in Hebrew, of praying in Hebrew. But that being said, I think that there are many other sources that talk about understanding what we're saying as well. Okay, Lynn just asked, should we think of this like computer programming language? Certain forces were designed to respond to Hebrew as a default preset, but no other code will compile and run them. That's very interesting. So there's actually a discussion whether the angels understand other languages or not, right? So one is that they don't understand it at all. Another option is they understand it, but they're not going to kind of connect those dots if you're not going to say it in Hebrew. So I like your analogy to computers. It is interesting to think about whether they understand it or not, and what that does for our prayer as well. So with that, I wish you all a safe week, a healthy week. I hope that we can continue our learning. Bezrat Hashem, we will meet again next week. If anybody has questions in the middle of the week, feel free to email me. And looking forward to learning again next week. So have a great week, everyone.